AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
This is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
I welcome my good colleague, Colonel Jeff McCauley, the United States Army retired and artilleryman. CBS News, Dickinson College visiting professor, Diamond Six Leadership and Strategy CEO. We're looking right now at several conflict zones. All can be called wars, but there's one great big story of the brain of the octopus is in Tehran. The arms of the octopus include Hamas of Gaza, Hezbollah of Lebanon, the Houthis of Yemen. Certainly the elements in the West Bank make up all kinds of tribes looking to cause conflict, including jihadists. The collapse of Syria and the threat to the whole region and the world with the ballistic missiles and cruise missiles that Iran is now demonstrating. There's chief sponsor of terror, the Tehran regime. Therefore, we're looking at what is to be done. Colonel, a very good evening to you. Thank you for this. The conversation now is about ending this war in some fashion, going past how it ends, if it ends, if there's a surrender or a flight of the regime or a collapse in Tehran. What then? And there is a challenge that was not met in Afghanistan, my opinion, that was not met in Iraq, my opinion. You were in the war with Iraq, and you commanded a unit in the liberation of Kuwait. The Iraqis did not fall down and hail liberators. They didn't do that in the 90s. They didn't do it in 2003. The likelihood of Iran falling down and hailing the liberators is minimal. Do we have a day after plan to your knowledge, Colonel? Good evening to you.
Good evening to you, John. No, and I think that's the right question because people focus on warfare and what bomb load you'll use and what airplane you'll use. But military force is a means and not an end. And so you got to say, what are we trying to shape with the use of military force as a future? It appears to me very likely now that the Israelis have moved beyond the what was their stated objective, which was just the destruction of Iran's nuclear capability. But by their expanded target set, they're now going after infrastructure. They're going after the Ministry of the Interior. They're going after the media. They're going after other government officials, in addition to military officers and senior scientists. And that looks to me a little more like a regime change objective. Mr. Trump's announcement of unconditional surrender would seem to suggest his mind is also moving in that direction. And one of our challenges has always been to answer that question, and then what? And I agree with you, John, wholeheartedly, that I do not believe the Ayatollah Khamenei will accept Mr. Trump's offer of unconditional surrender and will have a an appearance on a battleship like in September of 1945 in Tokyo Harbor. This is the same regime that, in fact, fought an eight-year war with Iraq and saw hundreds of thousands of young Iranians killed and did not pursue any kind of negotiated settlement for 8 years. The Ayatollah knows this war is existential for him personally, as he saw the leaders around him fall. He's seen Nasrallah fall and Hezbollah. And it's existential for him organizationally as far as the regime goes. So what then? Well, it won't be a democracy, John, I guarantee you. It could be an authoritarian state that's even more oppressive than the one we have right now. It could be a fragmented state, particularly because in addition to a large Persian population, you've got Baluchis and others who have been proposed to the regime, and a state of 91 million people, twice the size of Texas, that is a failed state, would be totally destabilizing in the region. So we really have to think about that, and then what? What happens next? And I dare say I don't see, nor have I heard, of much thinking in that direction going on in Washington, either in the Trump administration or, frankly, even before.
Needing attention is Ukraine-Russia. At the G7 meeting, we were told beforehand, Mr. Zelensky was invited to meet with the leaders of the G7 in the Rockies of Canada and Mr. Trump. Mr. Trump left the G7 early for the war in the Middle East, and Mr. Zelensky, to my knowledge, was left talking to like-minded members of the leadership about what needs to be done. I believe the first order of business these days is to vouchsafe the 500% tariff on anyone doing business with Russia, which is said to be something that they've thought about for some time, given that Russia has successfully maneuvered, avoided the sanctions passed so far by the EU, by the US, in this conflict. That has not happened, though there is a bill like that in the U.S. Senate. To your knowledge, will that move the story to make sure that Russia has no business whatsoever anywhere, including selling oil with the shadow fleet to India and China?
I don't know, John, but I certainly hope so, because I think what we're seeing now is more and more, if Ukraine is going to survive, it's going to be up to the Europeans to largely carry that load. That certainly has been the argument Donald Trump has made since he became president. And initially, it was my understanding, the United States, the Trump administration, opposed Mr. Zelensky even attending. So you could make the argument that perhaps Mr. Trump was rescued from having what he would have construed as an awkward meeting with Zelensky by the crisis and left early. It's clear he doesn't like, personally, any of the members of the G7. He does not have a good relation with our Canadian friends, for sure, and others. And second of all, the United States refused to sign up to the statement that had been issued or prepared by the G7 condemning Russia for its invasion of Ukraine 3 years ago. So neither of those things happened. But in addition to then the Europeans plus the United Kingdom voting in favor of those increased sanctions, I would hope they would also review the Russian frozen assets and move swiftly towards a transfer of those to the Ukraine. But while many members of the Senate, including Trump supporters like Lindsey Graham, have spoken about expanding sanctions on Russia, and there are supposedly 80 senators in favor of that legislation, I do not believe they will move an inch without the direct permission and blessing of the president.
One more. The war in the Middle East looks at this moment to be asking, is the U.S. going to get directly involved? Not as a supplier, not as an intelligence provider, not as a diplomat, but as a warfighter. Right now, my assumption would be that it is necessary to go to the representatives of the people. That would also be known as Congress. And for the president, if he is intending to get involved directly in the conflicts anywhere, that would be Ukraine, that would be Iran, that would be Gaza, anywhere. He needs to ask the Congress, Senate, and House to vote on the War Powers Act. To your experience and information, isn't that a next step that's logical to ask the American people if they approve?
Certainly ask their representatives. I mean, the attack on the Fordo nuclear power facility, which is the focal point, because if you're an Israeli planner and you don't destroy the Fordo facility, you would have to say that our mission, this operation Rising Lion, has really failed, because the Fordo facility is the one hidden 250 feet underground, 3,000 centrifuges, one of the primary areas for the enrichment of uranium to a level of 60% we know right now, and it could move swiftly to a level of 90% with that uranium in a few weeks, which would be weapons-grade uranium. The Israelis do not have the military capability to do that. The United States does, with a B-2 bomber combined with a 30,000-pound bunker buster earth-penetrating bomb. And so Mr. Trump now is certainly considering that possibility. Well, it seemed to me, John, that an attack on that particular base by the United States directly would, in fact, be an act of war. Certainly, if the Iranians attack the United States and attack the nuclear facility on U.S. territory, we would certainly construe it as an act of war. And therefore, there is a constitutional obligation for the president to go to the Senate, the representatives of the people, for a vote. But there has been little to no talk of doing that. And most people, I think, believe he will, in fact, ignore that, hanging his hat on the argument that when he rejected the analysis of his DNI, Tulsi Gabbard, who said in testimony to the Congress that it was the seven intelligence communities in the United States' opinion that Iran did not have a nuclear weapon and was still some distance from having a deliverable weapon. They might be able to get the uranium soon, but a deliverable weapon of maybe a year or more. Mr. Trump was asked about that just in the last day or so and said, I don't care what she says. I believe they were close, adopting the argument, frankly, that's been advocated by Mr. Netanyahu as his explanation for this war, that Iran was imminently going to acquire a weapon, and using that argument to avoid a protracted discussion in the Senate. Sadly, John, this has a rings very similar to something you and I remember only about 20-plus years ago, and that was 2003 when then-President George W. Bush argued that the United States must move swiftly because the Iraqis were going to have a nuclear weapon imminently and provide that to a terrorist group that would hit the United States. That was his argument. We know that no weapon was ever found. No evidence of producing a weapon was ever proven. And 4,500 young Americans died in the aftermath of the invasion of Iraq.
So what we have is back to the future. That's where we are. We can anticipate the White House won't want to go to Congress. We can anticipate that Congress will have an argument, but that the Republican Party will acknowledge the president's seniority and go along with the idea that we don't need a vote. Is that what you're seeing, Jeff?
Yeah, absolutely. The only representatives in the Congress that I've seen on the Republican side suggesting that this should be a vote in this Congress is Representative Massey from Kentucky, who's a conservative libertarian Republican, who is co-sponsoring a bill with a couple of Democrats. But the Speaker of the House doesn't want that to come to the floor. And in the United States Senate, the only Republican I've seen who's spoken about that at all has been Rand Paul, who we all know is a libertarian Republican as well. And the rest of the Republican Party seems to be willing to accept whatever decision is made by the president, moving Mr. Trump more and more in the direction, I think, which he has advocated more broadly, of the idea of a unitary presidency theory of the Constitution and an all-powerful president making decisions of policy, whether it's domestic, economic, foreign, or national security.
Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army retired artilleryman, CBS News, visiting Professor Dickinson College, CEO Diamond Six Leadership and Strategy. There's a big NATO meeting coming up in Europe in July. Jeff's a veteran of NATO. What to expect and what do we need? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Hey, Ryan Reynolds here. Wishing you a very happy half-off holiday, because right now Mint Mobile is offering you the gift of 50% off unlimited. To be clear, that's half price, not half the service. And Mint is still premium unlimited wireless for a great price. So, that means a half day, yeah? Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month plan equivalent to $15 per month required. New customer offer for first 3 months only. Speeds low after 35 gigabytes of network busy. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.